From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. For many of the leaders gathered at the UN in New York this week, their next stop is Pittsburgh. The G20 meets there on Thursday and Friday. The G20 consists of the big industrial countries plus the biggest developing countries. The group previously met under crisis circumstances last December. It was trying to fashion an emergency response to the global financial downturn. Now, as NPR's John Itzde reports, this week's focus is ensuring long-term stability.
At the top of the Pittsburgh summit agenda is an attempt to correct the mistakes that led to the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, among them a failure of regulation. Most of the headlines in the run-up to the meeting have involved plans to rein in the huge salaries and bonuses paid to bankers and traders. It's a cause that resonates in every country, says Ted Truman of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Every political leader and many business leaders, for that matter, have declared themselves as outraged, and it plays well in the political process.
France's President Sarkozy has proposed capping compensation for bankers. Dan Prince, who was President Bush's chief aide at the first G20 summit last December, says Sarkozy's proposal is a distraction.
Fortunately, President Obama and his advisors are on record opposing that, and rightly so. So, as I say, the final risk is that there is the possibility, as you run up to these things, that something kind of hijacks the attention and becomes a distraction from the important work of reform.
The leaders will likely endorse a set of compensation guidelines without caps. They'll also likely address the issue of requiring banks to hold more capital. But for the Obama administration, the most important work of reform is addressing global imbalances that American officials believe set the stage for the crisis. For instance, in the years before the financial meltdown, countries like the U.S. and Britain consumed too much and saved too little, while big export machines like China and Germany saved too much and didn't consume enough. Their huge saving surpluses helped create a huge pool of cheap money that led investors to take too much risk. The U.S. wants the G20 countries to agree to get their savings and consumption in closer balance. Nick Lardy of the Peterson Institute says for countries like China and Germany, that would mean increasing their consumption and relying less on exports for growth. For the U.S., he says, it's basically the opposite.
That we are going to be saving more, that the United States consumer is not going to be the globalist consumer of last resort.
Many of the G20's nations, including China, agree this rebalancing is a good idea in principle. But the Chinese are leery of signing up to meet specific targets, says Lardy.
They've adopted a lot of policies that will help move them in that direction, but I don't think they really have the confidence yet that they'll be able to sustain that. So they're very reluctant to sign up for an international agreement that would constrain them and might cause them to have to adopt policies that would lead to much slower growth.
Ted Truman, a former Treasury official who helped the Obama administration prepare for the last G20 summit, says that likely means no targets. Instead, he sees a role for the IMF keeping track of how the countries are doing, and then at future G20 meetings, he sees the leaders reviewing their own progress.
Discussing among themselves, well, we wrote this in September of 2009, and to what extent are we, either individually or collectively, living up to our commitments?
A global framework that eliminates economic imbalances might create more stable global growth. But history suggests the odds of implementation are low. Similar frameworks have been tried several times before in the past 25 years with little success. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. A year after Wall Street's meltdown, there's a major push to revamp how the financial services industry is regulated. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner made his case before a key House panel today. And in a moment, we'll hear from an influential senator, Democrat Christopher Dodd, on his ideas and how they differ from Geithner's. First, though, NPR's Audie Cornish was listening to the testimony in the House.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner urged Congress not to let any more time pass without dealing with problems in the financial regulatory system.
We can't let the momentum for reform fade as the memory of the crisis recedes.
The most vital of those reforms, said Geithner, are the proposed consumer watchdog agency and a plan to safely wind down financial institutions considered too big to fail. The latter was very much on the mind of House Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank of Massachusetts. Frank says he's determined to create mechanisms for shutting down failed non-bank institutions like insurance giant AIG.
There will be death penalties enacted by this Congress, but they will be for non-bank financial institutions that will not be considered too big to die.
But today, lawmakers focused on the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. The proposed agency would write and enforce rules over all areas of consumer credit, from debit cards to mortgages to PayPal. Republicans said it goes too far. In theory, it could cover any kind of consumer credit. Restaurant bar tabs, box store layaway, said Jeb Henserling of Texas.
Applebee's, rental car companies, Avis, Budget,
Congressman,
Enterprise,
I understand
every CPA
what you're doing.
In America.
I understand what you're doing. It's a reasonable proposition, the approach you're trying to take, okay? But let's just do the basic imperative. If you allow institutions that are essentially doing what banks do, to compete with banks with no adult supervision, no constraints, are free to engage in unfair defensive practices, then you will recreate again what this country
went through. Do CPAs compete with banks?
But Chairman Barney Frank is taking concerns like Henserling's into account. In a memo he sent to the committee last night, the chairman outlined a draft bill that would avoid ensnaring random retailers and only cover financial services companies. Frank is also dropping a provision that required banks and others to provide so-called vanilla versions of whatever they offer. For example, if a company had a rewards credit card with fees, it would have to offer customers the regular no-fee card so they could compare. The same for mortgages and so on. Frank said that didn't really make sense for the new agency.
The agency should have prevent bad things. I don't think it's the role of the government to try and stimulate good things. That doesn't work very well.
And at the hearing, Geithner agreed to scaling back those provisions.
So as I said earlier, I think the chairman's proposals that I've just had a chance to read very briefly are a pragmatic, helpful way to make sure that you have a better balance of choice but protection.
Geithner fended off arguments that the new agency would overlap with other regulators like the Federal Reserve and the FDIC. Conservative Democrats have lobbied for a council of existing regulators instead of the new agency, but Geithner would not budge.
Just let me say it starkly. Did that system work? How well a job did it do? How did it work out for the country? Our responsibility, your responsibility, is to figure out what's right for the country.
This was the first of an aggressive round of hearings that the panel has undertaken in an effort to get legislation passed this year. The committee will also take on proposals dealing with executive pay and shoring up bank reserves. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.
There will be much more talk about the economy today as world leaders gather in Pittsburgh. It's a summit of leaders of the world's 20 largest economies. And one issue they're expected to consider is whether to impose new restrictions on the financial industry's culture of paying big bonuses. American officials say the collapse of the financial sector last year was at least partly due to compensation practices that encouraged banks to engage in risky practices. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, the U.S. is at odds with other countries about what steps to take.
There's a kind of bipartisan rage being directed at the world's biggest financial companies right now. On talk radio, conservatives rail against the federal government bailout, furious that taxpayers have been forced to prop up bankers who took irresponsible risks. Meanwhile, on Wall Street this week, AFL-CIO head Rich Trumka led a protest demanding stricter regulation of banks.
We have a message for Congress. We're asking them, which side are you on? Either you're with us or you're against us.
The anger has mushroomed this summer following reports of more huge payouts for executives of big financial institutions, including some that received bailout money. And Paul Denicola, who studies corporate governance at the Conference Board, says banks are having to respond.
Boards are facing increasing pressure, be it from their institutional shareholders, or also from a public outcry to rein in executive compensation to a reasonable level.
In recent weeks, the Federal Reserve has taken up the cause. It's expected to release new regulations on executive pay within a few weeks. One change nearly everyone agrees on is a ban on compensation plans that encourage traders and brokers to engage in risky behavior. Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable says one example is what are called yield spread premiums.
It was a compensation practice
where the mortgage broker received a bonus if he sold a mortgage at an interest rate higher than the borrower would have otherwise qualified for. Well, that type of practice has stopped and did not benefit anybody except the mortgage broker.
But Talbot, whose organization lobbies on behalf of financial companies, opposes some of the other ideas now coming out of Washington. The House passed a bill this summer that would give regulators a lot more power to determine executive salaries. Meanwhile, because most big banks tend to operate globally, foreign governments are also weighing in. France and Germany have proposed strict caps on banker salaries. Talbot says that would be a huge mistake. He says it would mean banks would have to throw out the incentive-based compensation plans that help them compete. He also says draconian measures aren't necessary because after the crisis of the past year, most banks have become a lot more cautious anyway.
The threat of failure and the ghost of the institutions that have failed are threat enough for the institutions to change their practices to ensure that they stay in business, that their customers receive good products, and that their employees are compensated well.
But others are skeptical. J. Robert Brown of the University of Denver Law School says big banks might be acting responsibly now, but once the economy turns around, they'll revert to their old practices. As for the Obama administration, it has so far been cool to some of the more aggressive proposals, like the pay caps favored by some Europeans. But Brown thinks that may change. He says there's a growing sense that not much has been accomplished in the year since the financial crisis.
And I think for this administration, they need to fix something to say we took some steps to prevent this from happening again. And the most obvious step to take is to say we're not going to allow for the kind of compensation practices that may have caused this crisis to begin with.
U.S. officials are expected to release details of their compensation proposals over the next few weeks, and Brown says that will give them a chance to take a stand on a politically contentious issue and show that they're ready to reform a system that wreaked so much havoc last year. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Now, the leaders of those economic powers are meeting in a city that's been remade. Pittsburgh transformed its economy and now hopes to transform its image. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Pittsburgh's profile is on the rise. Bathed in the international spotlight, the city's reputation is climbing like one of the incline railway cars that scale the steep hillside along the Monongahela River.
This is Mount Washington. This is formerly known as the top of Coal Hill.
From this vantage point, Pittsburgh native Chris Bream has a commanding view of the city. The coal in these hillsides and the barge-filled rivers below helped make Pittsburgh a steel-making powerhouse for decades, up through the 1970s.
All along the river here, I mean, you would see the glow from the J&L plant, the LTV plants. That glow would have been day and night.
That glow faded in the early 1980s when one steel mill after another closed and more than 100,000 jobs disappeared. Bream, who's a regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh, says it took decades for the city to forge a new identity.
Steel defined Pittsburgh for a century. In this world where everything's more mobile, you know, investments hypermobile, talent and skills and workers and all these things are not tied to a geography the way steel was here. Regions are going to be competing in very different ways.
For Pittsburgh, the comeback's been fueled by investments in healthcare, education, and clean energy, industries the Obama administration wants to highlight. The city's convention center, where much of the summit's taking place, has been hailed for its environmental design. From this hillside, you can see Heinz Field, where the world champion Pittsburgh Steelers play. Earlier this week, the stadium was home to a technology conference, where the CEO of Google fielded questions about innovation and the global economy.
My question is about clean jobs and high-tech manufacturing. Do you think that these fields will ever completely replace the high volume of manufacturing jobs that have been lost over the last 30 to 40 years?
Pittsburgh high school student Pavan Rajkapal isn't sure if there's a clean job waiting for him, but this son of Indian immigrants said after the conference he wants to keep his options open.
It's the future, so it's definitely possible.
In the 1980s, young people didn't see much of a future in Pittsburgh. Working-age families fled the city in droves. Now, though, Pittsburgh's job market is healthier than the rest of the country's, and more young people are deciding to stay.
Can I get the Tsingtao?
In the days leading up to this week's summit, young people crowded a tasting room at the Sharp Edge Beer Emporium, sampling brews from half a dozen G20 countries. Teacher Kate Benson says people who graduate from Pittsburgh's good colleges used to think they had to go elsewhere for work. Not anymore.
I think that people have recognized over the last decade, especially, that it's a valuable place to be. You know, when it comes time to raise a family, you really can't beat growing up and raising a family in this city.
That's encouraging news for economist Breen, who says Pittsburgh residents are often the last to believe in their city's revitalization. He's proud of all the attention that Pittsburgh is getting, but he cautions the makeover is not finished.
What I hope doesn't happen is that we think we've arrived somewhere, because the answer to moving beyond steel is not looking for that one thing that will replace steel. Nothing will replace steel. We don't know what industries will be growing in 10 years. For Pittsburgh, and these lessons for everyone else, is to not get trapped in that. I hope we're not left thinking that, you know, this is the end, this is only the beginning of wherever the future goes.
Banners hanging all over town this week say Pittsburgh welcomes the world. A recession-weary world welcomes Pittsburgh's example that rebuilding an economy is possible. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Pittsburgh.